It's Eva Parfitt here for the Oral History Summer School. I'm sat here with Bobby Previtt. We are sat in Claverick, New York, and I'm collecting for the Community Library of Voice and Sound. Could I ask you, Bobby, to introduce yourself?
I'm Bobby Previtt. I am a musician. I live in Claverick, New York, in the beautiful Hudson Valley.
Great. So my first question for you is, could you describe a space that was important to you in your early life?
Wow. No one has ever asked me such a question. I think I would have to say my basement. Because in my basement, we had a very small house, and there were three children. I was the youngest by far. My brother, who has now passed away, was 13 years older than me, and my sister was 8 years older than me. So I always felt like they had some kind of, the whole family had like a life before I came along. And I was always sort of jealous of that life. But all to say, there were a lot of people in this little house. It was only a two-bedroom little house in Niagara Falls, New York, where I grew up. So the basement, I colonized the basement. And there I did, I played with my friends. I did all kinds of projects. When I got older, I tried to make a strobe light and tripped the electrics. All the lights went off in the house. I'll never forget that because all I heard from upstairs was, Bobby! and I knew, okay. But then I got my drum set. And that's where my drum set was set up. And that's where I spent my formative years practicing in that basement. So the basement was very, I would say, and before I even had a drum set, I made my own drum set out of garbage cans. This is a long answer for you. Is it okay? Well, my parents were not really, to put it mildly, into my wanting a drum set. And so I was kind of forced to improvise. So I made my first drum set out of, plastic bins turned upside down. And I had aluminum pie plates nailed to plungers for cymbals. And, I had a whole sort of ridiculous set that I should have kept because probably, I could have been more famous if I had kept that set. But all to say, I made that set in my basement, and I would practice on that set often, and I would turn off all the lights in the basement, and I would shine one, I would have one light on it, a shining on me, like a little spotlight, and I would practice with this light on me. And then finally I got my real drums and I set them up and then I practiced there too. And so my basement was my lair. It was the only spot that I had any privacy in the house. So I would say that's a really good question. It's a really interesting question because I really had to think about it, but I've never quite articulated the kind of meaning of that space for me. Fascinating.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the relationships in your family?
Well, my father was a factory worker. My extended family was a large Italian family. In Niagara Falls, there were many Italian people, lots of Italian people, and they're all mostly from Sicily. And there were a lot of factories in Niagara Falls at that time. In fact, if you ever want to read it, you should read some things about Niagara Falls. It's a wild, wild place to grow up and a crazy town. Just there's the falls, of course, which everybody knows on Earth. Everyone knows what Niagara Falls is, but no one knows anything about Niagara Falls. So it's really interesting. It was kind of a very depressed city. People have been trying to save it for years. No one can. I don't know what, you know, corruption. It's so corrupt. It's been corrupt. Its whole history is that of corruption. It has more toxic dumps than almost any per square mile than any place in the United States, Niagara Falls. In fact, there were some days where I would walk outside and my nose would be burning, and I would just think, well, this is one of those days, not knowing what it was. And, you know, I was on a baseball team because, you know, I played a lot of sports when I was young, and I think my dime, the baseball place where the kids played was like right next to the Carborundum and all the chemical factories. They were there because of the falls. They used to dump chemicals like right over the falls. Yeah, so it was a long story of the corruption and craziness in the city, and the mob, the Eastern Coast, East Coast headquarters of the Cosa Nostra was there, basically, in the hills of Niagara Falls. It's a really amazing story. My father was born in Pennsylvania, in the Pennsylwalkie, in the where the groundhog is, the town of the, you know, the groundhog. And he was a coal miner. And then he moved to Niagara Falls and got a job in a factory, met my mother. My mother was a kind of a famous Niagara Falls beauty. She was just gorgeous, right? Okay, so, and she would walk through the town, and she knew, of course, that she was gorgeous, and she would walk through the town, and she was a head turner. People would, whoa, like, and my father was taken by her, and, but she was from a very, very strict Italian family. My grandmother, who ended up being in the United States for 30 years, and who I was terrified of because she was always dressed in black for 30 years since her husband died, didn't speak a word of English, refused to learn English. And so they were a very, very strict family. And my father never was alone with my mother ever before they got married, like not even for a minute. Those were the days, right? It's wild to think of. Anyway, long story short, he saw her one day. My mother told me that, you know, your father, Bobby, he spent thousands of dollars on good times, you know, before he married me. And I believe it. I think I found out much later in life, because after I became a musician, my father was very against that. I found out later, after he had died, that his dream was to own a club. And I thought, wow, isn't that amazing? Like, all this time, like, he, of course, wanted me to be a doctor or something. But he wanted to own a club. That was his dream. And he never realized his dream. Because he got a job dutifully at a factory and, you know, came home with the paycheck. And my mother never worked. You know, he wouldn't allow her to work even, and she was fine with that, you know. And that was those are my parents. My mother was born in Italy. This is kind of a wild story. My grandmother came over on the boat in steerage, which, can you imagine, with five daughters and my mother, pregnant with my mother, seven months pregnant, by herself. In that era, the men would go over, make money, and then call for, right? And they got to New York Harbor, and there was some sickness on the boat. And they were quarantined in the harbor for a week or 2 weeks. I don't know. Like, imagine going all the way across the ocean and then still having to stay there. And then they got turned around and they had to go all the way back to Italy without setting foot in the United States. And so my mother was born in Italy because of that. She was born in Sicily. Anyway, that was my mother and father. They he worked in a factory, and we were, you know, kind of a lower middle class, but we always had food, you know, and I wouldn't say we were poor. We certainly weren't rich. You know, I wanted to play golf, so I went to the Salvation Army and got clubs. I this kind of thing. I always, I had a used bicycle, hand-me-down clothes. The violin is playing. But I had a very happy childhood, and my brother and sister, my sister was middle child, which she always, was complains about, because she was, the middle child is always kind of, ignored, maybe. I don't know. She has a thing, but my brother was the star of the family. He became he was an amateur painter and a champion horseman of purebred Arabians. He was very famous in those circles as a trainer, rider, and he was a very charming person. You would meet my brother, and he could get you to do his laundry in 3 minutes. He was just terribly charming, handsome, and a gay Republican in 1950 in Niagara Falls, which must have been really difficult. So those were kind of my family dynamics. My brother was also very difficult person, and we went in and out of having a relationship, and he was always in trouble, and he was always giving my father and mother tremendous grief, and which my sister was always so mad about, thinking, you're shortening the lives of our parents. He was a force of nature, my brother. Since he's died now many years ago, I've come to appreciate what we have actually in common, because I never really thought about it. My brother, everyone was sort of against me being a musician, and when my father died, my brother took over that role of being against me being a musician, and I said to him once, well, look, you do what you love. You love animals. You're a horse trainer. You make a lot of money doing it. It just so happens that your profession makes a lot of money. I'm also doing what I love, but it just so happens that my profession doesn't make a lot of money sometimes. And I tried to explain it to him like that, and he just said, well, I would just get a different profession. And that really shocked me. But I think that was a lie. So I've come to something, some kind of space with my brother now that I some kind of good space where I think about him often, and it's funny how these things happen.
I really like to hear the passion you have for music and how no sign or warning sign stopped you going down that path. Would you like to tell me a little bit about how you got on that path and what gave you that conviction?
Yeah, okay. Well, my father, before he was a factory worker, went to barber school. He went all the way through barber school, graduated, and hated it. Was a barber for like 15 minutes and said, I don't want to do this. But subsequently, if in an Italian family, if you have a skill, that skill is used. My uncle, my father's brother, worked also in a factory, but he was also, he taught himself to be a TV repairman. So he would come and every once in a while, you know, with his big box of tubes. Right? He would open up these box of tubes. I was fascinated by these tubes. And he would, you know, and after he left, our television was clear and it was great. But so my father, of course, cut everyone's hair in the family because, you know, right? He had a skill. You save money. So my father's brother had a son who was 1 year younger than me. And my father's brother was younger than my father. And subsequently, he was a little more urbane. He was a little more modern. He played tennis, you know. We always thought, he plays tennis. Like, what? That's so bizarre if you're from Niagara Falls, Italian family. Like, who plays tennis? Nobody plays tennis. So, but he played tennis. All right. And he ate salad. We said, so wow, this guy is, wow, he's modern. But so he passed it down to his son. And his son, Russell, my cousin, got a drum set one day. We went over and we would go and visit them. And we would especially go visit them because my father would cut my uncle and my cousin's hair. So we would go regularly, like once a month. So we went and there was this drum set. Now, I never forget. It was red sparkle drum set. And I came in, I looked at this drum set. I was like, wow. And so my cousin said, you know, you want to try it, and said like, and so the deal was that I could play my cousin's drum set, I kid you not, only for the time it took for my father to cut my cousin's hair. So literally I could play the drum set 15 minutes a month. And I remember the first time I sat down on the drum set, you see, quickly, the drum set is a very made up instrument. The drum set is the strangest instrument in the world because the drum set was not invented by anyone. The piano was invented by someone. And then subsequently people made improvements. The saxophone was, and all the keys on the, you know, the, yeah, sure, you have low keys on the piano and then you have high keys that are higher pitch, but they're all sort of the same, in the same area, right? The same kind of, they sound the same. It sounds like a piano. But think about a drum set. There's a tom-tom, boom. There's a cymbal that lasts really high and it lasts forever. There's a snare drum with these weird rattly, it's like a kind of a bastard instrument. And so it's a put together instrument, and it's only an instrument because of all the drummers in the 20th century who decided to play it as one instrument. Because a drum set is an instrument made up of other instruments. You can't say that about a piano. A piano is one instrument. Drum set has many instruments in it, but because it's been codified into a drum set by the musicians themselves, it became an instrument. So it's a very odd thing, right? I mean, you can change the pitch. Each drummer can change the pitch of his drum set. Can't do that on a piano. Where they are physically in space, how many of things, 100 tom-toms, one tom-tom, 75 cymbals, that's still a drum set. You know, each drummer decides what their drum set is, but it's still a drum set. So, this in mind, I sat down at the drum set, and I just started to play, and I was just completely and utterly lost in the sound. I thought, this is crazy. These cymbals ringing and these drums. I was just wow, and I was just totally seduced by the sonic nature of the set, which I still am. I still play in that manner. For me, the sonic nature of the drum set, the melodic possibilities of the drum set, that's just, to some people, a strange thing to say. I happen to believe it's the greatest melodic instrument in the world. But the melodic aspect and the sonic aspect of the drum set is much more interesting to me than any rhythmic aspect, which is always what it's used for. It's very, very interesting. So I was fascinated by the sound first, because it's music is about sound. It's not about theory. It's not about a piece of paper. It's not about it's only sound. It is sound, and sound hits your ear. What does it do to you? Does it move you? What kind of emotion is it? What kind of color is it? It's the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter what your technique is. What is the theoretical concept behind your compositions? That doesn't matter. It's only how you reach people. And so I was immediately reached. And so I asked my father to buy me a drum set. That was not happening. So I made that drum set I spoke to you about, and I practiced on that for a year in my basement while I saved money delivering papers until I could buy that drum set that's behind you that I got when I was 13 years old.
Oh.
Yeah, that drum set, which remains today. You know, I have many drum sets. I endorse companies and I have many drum sets, but that drum set is still the best. It's just an amazing sound. So I would go over there every month and I would work out stuff, you know, on my fake drum set, you know, work out things. And I would go there and I'd get, you know, get ready, Bobby. Okay, ready? And, you know, my cousin would be in the barber chair. Okay, go. And I would just try to get out everything that I'd done for the entire month in that 15 minutes. And I could barely do it because of the sound. I was so enthralled and seduced by the sound that I would sort of literally hyperventilate. It was very difficult for me to concentrate on doing something because I was, oh my God, listen to that, like this. And so I just loved the sound of the instrument so much. And, you know, I never thought I was going to be a musician. I wasn't supposed to be a musician. I have a cousin who, he's now passed away, but before he passed away, he made a book of every person in the family, extended family, from 1850 to now, thousands of people. And I read through this book. I'm the only artist in the entire book. I'm the only, not just musician, but only the only person who had a career in the arts. There was one art teacher, so maybe she also was an artist, to be fair. But that's quite extraordinary, I think, you know. Just to think of it like, really, not one person in all that time? Because you just didn't do that. Things were difficult for Italian immigrants, and you didn't go off to try to become, what, a musician? It's just not, it's not something you did. So I had to sort of create my life like that. And I was highly motivated. But in the end, I think the only way that I actually could become a musician, it was because my father passed away when I was 17, quite suddenly. Because he worked too hard, and he worked shift work, which will really do a number on your body, you know, different sleep patterns. And that allowed me to be a musician, finally, you know. I don't know if I would have been able to overcome, because he's a very powerful man. I don't know if I would have been able to overcome that to to be a musician. I may not have been able to. I may have would have ended up a dentist or something, you know. But he died, and then, well, I'm continuing on. This is sort of my life story here. Well, so when he died, after he died, I went to school at the University of Buffalo because it was close. I couldn't afford any other school. I couldn't afford to live at a school. I had to commute, and that was a close, it was a state school. And so I decided to go there. But I went there, of course, not for music. I went there to be in the pre-doctoral, pre-dental program. I took a lot of math. I took a lot of science because I was still, you know, my father's voice was in my ear. You know, you cannot be a musician. You just know. And so I, but by that time I was playing, of course. I really learned to play in the streets and the bars of Niagara Falls. I learned on the street. And that was the best education I could ever get. Because I was always playing in front of people. And I was always interacting with people instead of a book or a professor, you know. So it was great. And I still remember my first gig. Well, the first time I played in front of people was at a party, and I sat in, and I was so excited. I remember it like it was yesterday. Everything disappeared, literally. Like, I could not see anything anymore. Like, I was playing, and there was no, the people literally went away. Everything went away. It was the weirdest feeling in the world. I couldn't, my visual sense just left me. It was just this world of sound that was developing. So it was too much. And I had to learn, you know, to handle that, to literally handle the power of music. Because I had to, you know, musicians, they exist on these two levels. Because if you're any kind of good musician at all, you still are seduced by music. You still are, you have that feeling. If you don't, like, well, why are you doing it? But yet you have to play. You have to somehow use both sides of your consciousness, right? Your unconscious mind, your conscious mind, to have to strike some kind of deal. And I eventually learned that. But something very embarrassing happened. My first gig, of course. Shall I tell you that? I knew. Why did I know you were going to say yes?
Only if you want to.
No, of course. No, I don't. It's fine. I've told this story many times. But, you know, I was a teenager, and we were playing at a school dance, and I, you know, my very first gig, and I was playing, and I remember thinking, okay, this is it. This is all I ever want to do in my life. This is all I want to do. I love everything about this. I love the nighttime. I love the little red lights on the amplifiers. I love the music. I love all of it. And I especially like all the people watching me. And you know, especially I like all the female people like watching me. And I remember thinking, man, well, this is amazing. Like, I'm the center of attention. I'm the drummer. You know, the drummer is very physical. You know, you know, guitar, sure, twang, 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 move your fingers. But the drummer is like, yes, right, a lot of physicality. And I remember, and we got to the end of the set, and I was playing, and I would sneak looks, and yes, and many girls were watching me, and everybody was watching the band, and I was thinking, my God, this is incredible. We're going to end this set, and and I'm going to walk out into this sea of people like a young god or something. and then we got to the end, and we did, you know, the end of a rock song, many rock songs, you know, you have what's called a cadenza. Okay, and we got to this point, and we're doing it, I'm looking up, and you're now they're really looking at me, and I'm going, man, just a couple, one more minute, and that's it. And then we get to the, of course, at the end of the cadenza, you always have a last note, right? A very strong last note, right? Bow! And so we got to the, and I'm looking up, and we get to the last note, bow! But somehow, as we did bow, as I came down on the cymbals and I bow, I must have exhaled especially strongly, and all this stuff came out of my nose, down my shirt. and I looked, I was like, oh no. And like, oh, I looked up and they were all laughing. And then they were all pointing and laughing at me. And I thought, oh my God, this is, life is not turning out like I thought quite. Anyway, that was, it's been uphill since then. But that was my first gig. And then I, you know, I just kept playing around at the bars of Niagara Falls, learning, playing. And then I went to the University of Buffalo to study music. And that was good because I had already been a musician. And then I, my mind was blown by John Cage, Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, Thelonious Monk, Ioannis Xenakis, Edgard Varèse, Beethoven, you know, all the music that did not exist on the radio when I grew up.
Could you maybe tell me about a specific musical experience you had that caused a shift in you or in your life?
These questions are amazing. They're very good questions, I must say, that caused a shift in my life. Well, you know, there's plenty of music that I heard and not played. I remember hearing the great drummer Billy Hart, who became a friend, a good friend after that, who was given a jazz master status. In National Jazz Master, which he richly deserves, great drummer. I remember seeing him at a bar in Buffalo, New York, in Herbie Hancock's band, and that changed the entire way I thought about the drum set. I realized at that moment that the drum set was a circular architecture and not a linear architecture, and I needed to play not in a linear fashion. This might not make much sense, but in a circular fashion. I needed to feel like I was in the center when I sat at the drums of a circle surrounding me, rather than, you know, in this straight line is this cymbal, and in this right side straight line is this cymbal, and if I look down, it's my snare drum. Instead of these lines, a beautiful, ever-moving, ever-fluid, changing circle. And when he played, I saw that. And that changed my life. And later, I got a NEA grant to go and study with him, and it was hilarious because I went to New York to study with him for 3 weeks, and I played for him, and he just laughed, and he said, you know, he's calling Previtt, what am I supposed to teach you? You already play, you know everything, you know, you're writing music. That's what I want to do. That's what you're doing. What I want to do. But he taught me a lot, of course. But we didn't sit there and go, okay, now do this or do this. He just took me to every gig he had, and he was a famous drummer, so he played with the most famous jazz musicians in the world. So I would be at go at the Village Vanguard backstage, and he would say, "Oh, Bobby, here's this is Pharoah Sanders. Pharoah, this is Bobby." And I'd be, "Oh, hello, Mr. Sanders." You know, so it was great. I mean, he would just take me everywhere, and you know, he drove me through Harlem, and said, "This is where Minton's was, where bebop was invented," and you know, I remember one time specifically he was trying to explain to me about bebop. You know, the thing about musical movements is they exist in a time. They exist in a moment, and that's when they're powerful, and they come to exist for reasons, those socioeconomic, whatever reasons, and they are of their time. This is why, you know, I did a piece 10 years ago where I rearranged a mass by Guillaume Dufay from the 15th century, and I paired it with a metal band, but that's another conversation. But I paired it with a metal band because I wanted to feel what was the power of this music then when you were in a stone church and there was no amplifiers or airplanes, when it was the loudest sound you could hear was powerful. Right now it's music for brunch, you know. Oh, so here's a nice choir doing this nice music, which isn't to say it shouldn't be performed. It's only to say, you know, music existed in a time, and that was its power. So he was trying to explain to me what bebop really meant to the musicians, the black musicians who invented it in the 50s. It wasn't just music. It never is. It's always everything. As Cecil Taylor says, music is everything you do. It's everything. So I guess I wasn't quite getting what he meant by the power, you know, the social aspect of it. And we were driving in the car, and he just punched the accelerator and made a 360 turn and went through a red light. And I just looked at him, and he said, "That's bop. It's a state of mind. It's not a set of chord changes." Sure, yeah, technically it is. People get too hung up on these kind of things, the technical aspect of this form. Well, this form employs, choral theory. Those are just details, you know. So that meant a lot to me, meeting him. And certainly, there's a lot of people I played with over the years who taught me a lot, just not even saying anything to me, just in their body language. Because, you know, body language is, as they, that theory 738-55 says, which has been kind of proven to be true, is people, when you're trying to communicate with someone, the meaning that you're trying to impart to them is, there's three components of it, and these are percentages. 7% of what you're communicating to the person is what you're actually, the content of what you're saying. Can you imagine this? Only 7% of what you're saying is communicating to the person. 38% is your tone. This is what I mean about sound. Drummers come to me for a lesson, or what the first thing I do, okay, what does it sound like? It doesn't matter what you're doing, what your some great beat or what, I don't care. What does it sound like first? But then the 55% is body language. That's astonishing. It's just an astonishing thing. So that's how I learned. I learned to watch people and get meaning from them by how they moved, basically, you know, very important. And so those were, that's a really fantastic question. I have to think about that after this interview.
So you mentioned rearranging, and you used metal music to recontextualize that piece. I wondered what motivates you to rearrange or compose?
Naivete, perhaps. Thinking that the next thing I write might mean something. You know, I mean, that's as good an answer as anything, really. Because, God, I don't know. I just have maybe a problem to solve, or I usually, to not be flip about it, for once, Bobby, usually I hear a sound first. Big surprise, right, for what I've been saying all along. I hear sound first, and then I try to decipher what that sound is. Okay, what is that sound made up of? Oh, that's a harp. Okay. Oh, pedal steel. All right. Bass. Yes. Accordion? Maybe. Right? So this is how I sort of piece together things. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine. It's interesting. He said, you know, I've got like hundreds of tunes on my hard drive that I've made. And I realized I don't have that. He said, writing music is therapy for me. And I just laughed inside. I thought, it's certainly not therapy for me. Writing music is sometimes excruciating, you know. I do it because I do it because I guess I have to. And I do it because I hear the sound and then I have to figure out what it is. But I've always been more of a project-based you know, I have a group, I want to write for the group, or I hear a sound, I want to do that, or I have a tour, or I have a gig, or I have, you know, okay, I need money, you know. Artists create so much because they simply need money, you know. Okay, I better come up with my next play because, right? So I think for me, I hear the sound first, and in that case, you know, I had an idea. This Dufay Mass I really loved. I remember hearing it when I first went to school. But, you know, I was brought up not only music on the radio, but I was brought up Catholic. So I had this weird, you know, I would hear the music of the church and then pop music on the radio. So this Dufay Mass I really loved, and I thought, okay, this Dufay Mass does not need me or anybody else, but I'm still going to do something with it, right? This is the incredible conceit of artists, you know. We all think that, you know, we can do all these things. And as I said, but I, you know, I wanted, what could I do with this as raw material? And I thought, I'm going to, you know, I had a third element of the piece too, but the main thing is I wanted to pair it with something that, a music that was as powerful now and as shocking now as that music was, you know. And metal music, you know, metal music is pretty reviled in a lot of circles, you know. It's, and I understand, I agree in a way, sure, you know, it's very harsh, it's very aggressive, it's very male, which, you know, we absolutely could use less of, you know. But I'm always intrigued when something is reviled. You know, I always, my ears perk up when people, you know, hate something. Or so I thought, okay, this will be interesting. So anyway, my processes are, they're very different. I put out a solo electronic record 2 years ago based on the new satellite that was taking all these incredible pictures, you know. And, you know, I didn't start out going, I'm going to make an electronic record, you know, based on all these incredible pictures that are coming. Rather, I was moving one of my old electronic pieces of gear one day that I hadn't used in like 2 years, and I was thinking maybe I should sell this, and I plugged it in to make sure it worked, and whatever setting it happened to be on, it started playing this thing. And so I immediately like walked over to my recorder and I recorded it, and that became the basis of this entire record. So I said, okay, so because many times I need, this is something I always teach in my workshops, is, you know, the first thing you have, the first thought, the first motion, the first movement, the first thing has more to do with the unconscious than the rest of it. You know, you do something, and then you work on it, and that's very, very in your conscious mind, right? But the very first thing is like a gold moment, right? It's like, oh, that's the thing that's, where did that come from? I don't know. Did it come from me even? Maybe. So I'm very aware to use those things that I feel just come to one, you know, rather than always having to make decisions and think of something in your head or, right? Things, music will make itself if you just get out of the damn way. You just get out of the way and it'll happen. This is the great lesson of some of the great musicians like Mike Miles. It will happen if you just let it alone, almost. But if you put too much on it, if you put too much politics, too much theory, too much this, too much that, it's just going to drag it down. And I've always sort of, well, I feel like I've always felt that, but as you get older, you know, you one good thing about getting older, there's one, maybe there's two, I don't know, but it is that you start to understand some of these things. You start to be able to verbalize some of these things that you've thought your whole life, or you, more accurately, you've felt your whole life. You know, I don't know if it makes you understand them more, but suddenly you realize why, and you could say, oh, yes, I've been operating like this, and this is kind of why I've been operating like this. It's a little bit confirming, you know. I don't even know if I answered your question, which seems to be a recurring theme with me in interviews. But anyway, that's my very complicated answer to your very simple question.
Well, it's a big question, isn't it, really?
It is a very big question, yes. You're only asking the big questions, which I love, by the way. It's you know, being interviewed is, you know, is it really, if it's really an interview, well, then it has to be a little dangerous, you know? It has to be a little terrifying. It can't be otherwise. Otherwise, you know, why bother? And, you know, I've been, as I said, you had asked me this question. I've been interviewed for by some really bad interviewers. And I've been interviewed by some super pro, great, you know, amazing interviewers. And the difference is that the good ones bring you to places you wouldn't maybe go, or you might not even have verbalized before. You might not go. Maybe you don't even want to go, you know. But you do, because it's a thing, you know. The recorder's there, and you're there, and you know, and as much as you would say to me, you know, oh, you know, you don't have to answer any question, which is, of course, you know, and you could stop the recorder anytime. You get into the flow, and then that's it. And you know, it's all about flow. Everything is flow.
Maybe switching gears a little bit, I just wanted to ask you what brought you to this area of the world.
Well, being from Western New York is very similar to this. I had been in New York for 30 odd years in my apartment on the Upper West Side. Nice apartment. Touring the world, coming back to my apartment, playing in New York, putting bands together, making records, you know, ad infinitum. I was on a track, you know. And it was great. I mean, I was having dinner with a friend of mine who was also on that track. And we were saying, well, you know, the good thing, I often say, you know, the best thing about my job, I try to tell this to students, they don't understand. Maybe they will someday. I say, you know what the best thing about what I do is? The best thing about what I do is not that I get to play music. The best thing about what I do is that I get to stand next to genius musicians and listen to them. And listen to them. This is something extraordinary. I'm 3 feet away from some of the greatest guitar players in the world, some of the greatest, I'm the greatest improvisers in the world. I'm right there. And so why think of playing? I mean, of course I play, but I also think this is an opportunity for me to listen, to hear. And so I had been on this track of doing, achieving, creating, which was great. And, you know, it was wonderful. I went all over the world. I played in some beautiful places for some beautiful people and had a great time, you know, and I got to share my life with some really interesting people, you know, who are also crazy, you know. And so, you know, the stories abound, you know, tour stories abound, and we all laugh and we all understand. We used to call everyone else civilians, you know. You know, it's like, oh, there's a lot of civilians at this train station, but we got to make this train. You know, just the stories of trying to get to the gigs, just that, there's hundreds of them, and they're great. So I had a wonderful time. But one year before my wife and I moved here, we got this offer to house sit a villa outside of Florence. And Florence is a city where I have a lot of friends, and I played many times. I played all over Italy many times. And so we had this free house sitting at a villa. The deal was they were selling it, so we were supposed to open it up when they were going to show it. But it turns out we only had to do that once in 3 months. The rest of the time, we were just there. This, and my friends were 20 minutes away in Florence. If we wanted to go in, we just would go in and we'd hang out. And I, of course, I took the opportunity to tell everybody in Europe that I was living there for 3 months, you know, so I could just go and play concerts. I'd just drive and play. It was amazing. We got back to New York, and I realized, oh, my God, it was in the summer that we went. And I said, oh, my God, I can count on one hand all the times that we had lunch or dinner inside. We were always outside under the, they had a beautiful big tree and a table, you know, and a, it was just, and I said, I have got, I just now have got to have an outside component in my life. I just cannot be in an apartment anymore. I just can't do it. And we had some friends, a really great visual artists called E-Team, who live in Cairo. And they're great. They're Germans. And we met at the McDowell Colony. You're not supposed to call it a colony anymore. The McDowell Residency, McDowell Place, something. And which is where Andrea and I met. My wife is the artist of the family. I'm just, like, trying to do things, okay? Like, my wife is, I'm astonished every day at her. She's just, like, beyond. And she was there. My wife said she's a theater geek. She was a dancer. Now she's a novelist. Now, recently, she's on her second film. It's like, you know, I just do music. I don't, you know, like, these people are like, what? And anyway, we met there also. When I met E-Team, and we met at McDowell. We got engaged at McDowell a year later. And a year after that, we went back and got married at McDowell under the same tree. But they moved here, and we had come by here. We were on our way from the north, and we had stopped in Hudson just by chance. And I thought, oh, this is a kind of nice town. This was like 15 years ago. This is kind of cool. All right, filed it away. And then they moved, and we came up and visited them. And, you know, they're visual artists, so their house, they have a little tiny house, but, of course, they're visual artists, so they did this incredible job with it, right? It's amazing, right? And we asked them, we're like, well, you know, how much did you pay for this house? Can we ask? And they were like, oh, you know, and they have a little land and the creek. It was like $65,000. I was like, what? We might be able to do that. But what they didn't tell me was they put $100,000 into it to make it into, it was just a shack. But they didn't say that. So we said, you know, we started looking. Of course, you can't find anything. We saw things with like a tarp roof, you know, for. But eventually we were really fortunate and we found this place. It was the worst time to sell a place. It was mud season, which is March here. Everything is brown. Everything is wet. Nobody's looking for a house. But we had been looking for a year, and we knew instantly that this was our house. Just, it was like, this is our house. And I don't know, we were lucky. We were just lucky. You know, I had recently gotten a large grant, and we were able to put a down payment on, and we had, you know, Andrea had an actual job, so she had, it, you know, a credit history, and you know, they don't like musicians, you know. And we were able to get the house, and we picked this because there was a lot of musicians here. And so when we came, it was really great because I started to meet all the musicians that were here, and I started to do these concerts, not of my own music, but I used to do this. I still do. I mean, I just got back from from Germany doing this, because it's Miles Davis's 100th birthday had he lived. And, you know, Miles is very not problematic. You know, people are complicated. You know, he's a complicated person. He's a brilliant artist, one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, but, you know, very complicated person. There's misogynistic. He could be somewhat abusive. You know, it's, this is a difficult question that I don't want to talk about because, you know, it's, but all to say, I love this record he did, Bitches Brew, which was from the 70s. And so I used to do this at the Knitting Factory in New York every week in the 90s. I put a band together to do this record, and we played, and then people heard about it, and so we toured it. And so it's a great template to teach people. So I travel places and I teach people. Like, so when I went to Hamburg and we had a band of German musicians, and I taught them Bitches Brew over the course of 3 days, and we played a concert. So that's what I started doing here. I decided I'm not going to do my own. I'm not going to be the guy coming in, okay, I'm going to do my music now, and let's do Bitches Brew, because everybody will like that. It'll be fun, and it won't be my music, so it won't be so charged. And that's how I kind of got in and met a bunch of people, and it's been really great. There's some great, great musicians here, and also artists of all different kinds. Of you, I'm sure you know, and so it's been nothing but good. And I've played much more here than I could have had I stayed in New York, because I can pick up the phone here and just say I'd like to do a gig every Sunday at Avalon, and Liam will say, okay. You know, try that in New York City. You know, you have to send 259 emails, you know, and it's just pressure. And so I'm kind of done with that, you know. As I get older, I realize the things that are really important to me now is, you know, one thing that's really important to me is trying to not just do things for me, but to I know this sounds, I don't mean it to sound that way, but to do things, to pass on some of the things that I may have learned, you know, I find that to be more important. I find that I'm thinking about that, which I never did when I was younger. Of course, when you're younger, it's all about you, you know, it's just all about you. So now I'm very conscious of a lot of the musicians, all of them almost are younger than me. And it's a very special position for me to be in, you know, and I have to be mindful, you know, that of that, because I have this history, and because the musicians, a lot of musicians here know that. For whatever use that is or what, but so I'm enjoying the feeling of being able to give something and see that in them. It's actually way more satisfying than playing a concert, which has been really shocking to me. I always thought that nothing would ever be as satisfying as playing a concert to me, to playing music. But I have to say, it is. I now teach at Ramapo College. I teach one course. I'm an adjunct, and I teach digital improvisation, a bunch of kids with laptops who don't think anybody else exists in the world, and I make them play with each other. They go like, what? Like, as I said, yeah, this person actually exists, and now you have to play with them. What are you going to do about that? And so we do a concert at the end, and they go from from zero to, like, they go from being mystified to working together in this beautiful, beautiful way. And, you know, it's very selfishly satisfying, you know, for me. And it's great. I love it. I love that feeling. And I feel like that's what I should be doing. And I could only do that because I moved here. So I think it's been nothing but good. I mean, that's the reasons I moved here. What has happened to us since then have far eclipsed any kind of reason that we thought to move here, which is really a lot. It's a story of life, right? You do things and they go a different direction always, right? They always go a different direction. You could never have predicted. Luckily, this has so far gone in a really good direction. So, really love it here.
Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
I'm wary that we're coming towards the end of our time, talking, listening. And I wondered if there was anything that you wanted to talk about that you haven't had the chance to, given the questions that I've asked.
Well, we haven't said a word about Hudson Hall.
Do you want to
talk about don't know if that's part of the oral history, but, you know, my time here has been greatly enhanced by my relationship with them, my relationship with Tammy, you know, Tamara Dillon, who I met through my friend Anthony Kramer, who is a big music fan. When I was in a band with my friend Charlie Hunter, he showed up, and he's just a great, great personality, and he's a big fan, and he also produces some things, and he's a very generous person, and he introduced me to Tammy. And from then on, I've done a lot of things at Hudson Hall. I did a lot of projects there. I think I did the first project to open their new space. And, you know, I'd done their gala and a couple of their galas. And so they've been really instrumental in my doing some of the bigger projects that I wanted to do here. You know. So it's a great place. Good on them. Well, I think that's maybe what I have to say.
Great.
Unless you have anything more.
No, that's perfect. Thank you so much for sharing. I've got so many images stuck in my head, and I can't wait to.
That was a very fascinating interview. Who knows whether it'll be interesting to anyone on Earth, but. it was good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah.
I just have to state the date. It's the 29th of May, 2026. Yeah, and thank you for your time, Bobby.
Thank you very much.
Perfect.